Before we begin today's show, I have some important news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June the 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $94,000 by that date. The great news is generous friends of the ministry have offered a new $5,000 matching grant, which will double your gift today up to that amount. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're talking about something which we've never really talked about on the podcast before, which is human resources, HR. But before you switch off, the most scintillating topic, but before you switch off, we are going to make it interesting, aren't we, Dad?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it does sound deadly dull, but actually, I think HR turns out to be one of those things which is of such incredible importance, both in the world as a whole, certainly true in my experience working as a doctor and as a research team leader, but also absolutely in the established and Christian church.
Mm. And it's a shame in some way that HR has become the kind of catch-all label, because I think really what we're talking about is how do you work well and love people, you know, image bearers. We're talking about how, you know, human resources is this kind of mechanistic idea, but actually we're talking about when people are engaged in some enterprise together, whether it's a church, a business, a charity, a sports team, like how do we live well and work well together?
Actually, you know, that's a very good point, because I think that's where the rot starts to set in, actually, in that name. Because the theory is, I've got a lot of resources. I'm a manager and I've got a lot of resources. I've got all that machinery. I've got all this, you know, stuff over here. I've got some financial capital.
And yes, now exactly. I've got my human stock of capital.
So, and simply the humans are just part of the resources and I juggle them around. I need a bit more financial capital. I mean, less human resources, you know. And that fundamental, that is a profoundly dehumanizing and... Yeah. It's interesting, it used to be called personnel management, which is a much more appropriate, at least we're talking about the personnel, these are people.
These are persons,
Once you've got this dehumanized idea that your workforce is simply a resource to be juggled, the rot has already set in.
So the kind of thing that kind of triggered this conversation was, as I mentioned sometimes, when I'm not doing this podcast, I'm a journalist and a large part of my reporting is on the Church of England and the kind of inner workings of that denomination. And perhaps the major story of the last kind of 10 to 15 years of the Church of England has been the safeguarding kind of crisis. It's not unique. Obviously, people will know lots of other denominations. Most famously, perhaps the Roman Catholic Church have been kind of wrestling with revelations of abuse in the kind of modern era and realizing just how deep seated and how commonplace it has been for churches to harbor abusers. And the Church of England is no different. It's got a long sordid kind of tale of bishops and clergy and others who've been revealed as abusers. And a large part of what the church has been trying to do over the last 15 years when it's not talking about gay relationships has been trying to kind of improve and fix its what's become known as safeguarding. How you protect children and vulnerable adults, how you set up policies and systems and procedures so that the kind of scams of the past can't happen again.
Yeah. And as so often, it's kind of unintended consequences, isn't it? That the whole move to safeguarding is very appropriately motivated. It's a very noble desire, yes, to try and protect the most vulnerable people in our midst from the kind of terrible, egregious abuse which which has been going on in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what part of the challenge is, you know, what we talked about is that safeguarding can become quite mechanistic, and it falls down in, you know, are you following the policy correctly? Have you completed the right safeguarding training modules? Are you, you know, following best practice? And sometimes it can become kind of completely ground down into this mechanistic way. And actually the church sporadically tries to kind of lift people's head and say, this is actually a theological issue. This is about, you know, what does Jesus say about protecting children? Some very, very strong words, millstones, round necks, all that stuff. You know, this is a critical, urgent discipleship, theological, Christian task, first and foremost, which we are trying to implement through these kind of mechanistic HR things. To bring this into land, so the Church of England has this thing called the National Safeguarding Team, the NST, which is they've built up over the years, this central resource who do a lot of their safeguarding investigations and lead on developing policies and that kind of thing. And as part of their effort to kind of be transparent, the Church of England has invited in this outside consultancy to kind of audit the NST. So kind of they come in and ask some questions and poke around and look and see how well is this team, the NST, the safeguarding team, working to keep people safe. And that audit was published just a month or so ago. And it was actually encouragingly quite positive on the whole about the NST. But one of the recommendations really jumped out at me, which is that the NST should build up a specialist HR department which can differentiate between conduct, HR and safeguarding issues. And this gets into a really kind of knotty technical issue, I think it's really significant, which is that as safeguarding has kind of exploded in salience and importance in the church world, not just in the Church of England, but in lots of other denominations, but in the C of E world, it's become massive. So when I first started covering this 2013, 2014, there was one part-time person working on safeguarding in the whole National Church of England. And that person was shared with the Methodists. 0.5. Today, there are 55 people working on this national safeguarding team alone. Just 12 years later. So you can see how much this has exploded in size. It's a huge, millions of pounds are spent each year. But as safeguarding has got bigger and bigger, what has become challenging and maybe an unforeseen consequence is that more and more things get sucked into the safeguarding bucket, get referred to safeguarding teams that actually are HR issues that aren't involving a child or a vulnerable adult.
So why do you think that is? What is this actually? Because everybody gets safeguarding training, don't they? We sit yes. down and we watch videos and definitions are given and so on. Mm. So why is it that now, whenever there's any kind of conflict or disagreement or harsh words are spoken or whatever, immediately the button gets pressed? This is a safeguarding issue. You know, this is not just a personnel management issue.
I think there's a couple of reasons come to mind. So one is an ambiguity around the definition. So the kind of classic definition of safeguarding is it's preventing harm to children, so that's anyone aged under the age of 18, and also adults, so 18-year-olds and over, who are deemed to be vulnerable. Now the question is, what is a vulnerable adult?
So I'm a vulnerable adult because my rector has just sort of bawled me out, and I'm feeling bruised.
You're feeling bruised and emotionally vulnerable, yeah. So there are some people who would say that. They say literally experiencing something which you didn't like, it makes you automatically vulnerable, and therefore everything is safeguarding. But even if you don't take it that far, you know, you or I might say, well, vulnerability in this sense is clearly people who are legally over the age of 18, but maybe share the vulnerability of children. So for example, that's how it's defined in law. There's the Care Act 2014, which is one of many laws that addresses this, and it says an adult who has needs for care and support or is experiencing or at risk of abuse and neglect, and as because of their needs is unable to protect themselves against the abuse or neglect. So this is basically someone who, although they are an adult, they have a disability, maybe a learning difficulty, maybe something else that makes them unable to protect themselves. So you or I, who do not have any reason that we were unable to protect ourselves, shouldn't, in my understanding, be classified as vulnerable. But there is a concerted push by some to broaden the definition to say, if you're a junior in a kind of work relationship, you know, let's say a vicar to a parishioner or an entry-level person to their line manager, you are vulnerable just in that relationship. You're not vulnerable when you go to the cafe at lunchtime at work, but in that relationship you are vulnerable. And so any incident or disagreement or conflict between you and your boss is automatically a safeguarding concern.
Yeah, you can see what a can of worms this is. I mean, I'm just thinking about in my work in medical ethics, a comparable definition is the definition of whether somebody has legal capacity or not.
Mm.
But their legal capacity is really quite clearly defined.
Yeah.
As to whether somebody has the capacity to receive information, to weigh and balance it, to understand the information and to make a decision. And that's something that clinical psychologists, for instance, and psychiatrists would assess someone in order to work out whether or not they have legal capacity.
Mm.
This is rather different, though, isn't it? Because you could imagine that someone could technically have legal capacity, but for some reason they are more vulnerable than the average. And certainly... Yeah. By definition, almost, as you say, someone junior is more, at least in theory, is more vulnerable to abuse within the workplace than someone who's very senior and experienced.
And I think this comes down to the fact that vulnerability is a spectrum and that it's not black or white. You are either vulnerable or not. That people are more or less vulnerable dependent on a dizzying array of factors. And yeah, there might be some people, you know, say someone who has some form of autism or someone who is physically disabled in some way. They are always vulnerable. That's just an everyday part of their life. But there might also be people who are, you know, neurodiverse in some other capacity or maybe are diagnosed with something like ADHD, which kind of waxes and wanes, or their vulnerability waxes and wanes dependent on numerous other things or any other number of mental health concerns. And I think part of the challenge is that as our understanding of the complexity and diversity of human brains and how human people work and think and engage with each other, there are ever more categories and ways of thinking about vulnerability. You know, someone who in a previous generation would just go through their life thinking that they're a bit scatty and disorganized today might get a diagnosis of ADHD and that, you know, previously no one would recognize them as vulnerable, and now, well, are they vulnerable? I don't know.
So what's the problem with every HR problem being called a safeguarding issue? Why not? I mean, I think some people would say, well, at least it's clear. We press this button, an outsider comes along and gives a judgment. Yes. Isn't that a good way of managing conflict in churches?
Yeah, and some people, again, explicitly make that case that we should basically, you know, utilise this as the best way. The problem is, and this is what the outside consultants said when they audited the Church of England safeguarding, is they said a persistent challenge, this is their language for the NST, was how many referrals it got about stuff that were ultimately deemed to be non-safeguarding. So this is a quote. They were said to often relate to conduct or disciplinary issues, and while not actionable by the national safeguarding team, their volume was noted to be impacting capacity. On occasions, we saw evidence that issues or concerns that should have been HR were blurred or misunderstood, and they were passed on to the safeguarding team simply to ensure an immediate, robust response. So basically, reason why it's a problem is that you're fundamentally distracting resource and taking time away from investigators and lawyers and pastoral teams who should be focused on children and vulnerable adults at risk of abuse. They're instead litigating conflicts between two competent adults who should be able to deal with this A, by themselves, or B, through standard HR processes. But I think the other problem is that it makes it harder for the safeguarding stuff to kind of be properly dressed with. So, you know, if we poison the well by saying everything is safeguarding, then nothing is safeguarding, because actual things of abuse get muddled in with all these, you know, my vicar shouted at me and I didn't like it, or, you know, another common one would be, you know, a consensual affair between two members in a congregation, two adults. It's wrong, it's morally wrong, and it is a pastoral concern. Absolutely it is. And it may, if one of them works for the church, it may even be an HR issue. But if they're two adults with legal capacity, why is nothing to do with safeguarding? And yet, if we lump that automatically in, then other, you know, a case where maybe a 17-year-old and the vicar are having a sexual relationship, he can say, "Oh no, 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 it's an affair," you know, and it blurs the lines between what we need to keep really crisp and clear, which is things that are morally suspect and in a workplace unhelpful, and stuff that is a question of harm and abuse.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, other problems which I've seen is that, first, it often seems the sledgehammer to crack a nut, you know, that something which could have been resolved almost immediately within, you know, by an apology and an open discussion, now becomes a, quote, safeguarding issue, which takes weeks or months to resolve.
Sometimes years.
You know, reports are written and outside people come along and people are interviewed. And then the other problem is that it seems that we can't have transparency because, no, I'm sorry, I can't talk about that. It's a safeguarding issue. So suddenly now, and of course, now there's this great deep secret. You know, what happened on Thursday afternoon? Everyone else, you know, tongues are wagging and speculation is growing. And I know we can't say anything. It's a safeguarding issue. Mm. And that just seems like, again, it's just unintended consequences. Often the rumour mill is absolutely goes into overdrive.
Yeah. And it's a classic example for me of how, as you say, the unintended consequences of how big institutions work is almost once you, you know, so once we realised that we needed that, you know, abuse was a problem, we needed to go from one part-time person to a team of 55 people. And, you know, you've kind of created this internal investigation police force and, you know, by church law, every parish has to prominently display its safeguarding procedures and have a safeguarding officer to refer things. And like, as you create the infrastructure, everything just gets sucked into it because it's the path of least resistance. And so, you know, 20 years ago, if you had a problem, you went to your vicar to chat about it and you tried to hammer something out. And if they couldn't agree, they might have gone to chat to the bishop. Whereas now, because there is this kind of path that's been worn smooth by repeated usage and by prominent kind of communications campaigns telling everyone, report anything, even if you're not sure, report everything, then of course that's what happens. Everything, even with the best in the world, will get sucked into this groove. And as you say, stuff that could have been dealt with by a conversation between grown-ups, well, it's safest, isn't it, just to do what we've been trained to do endlessly. I'll refer it on, and it gets sucked into the safeguarding machine. And you know, at that point, sometimes terrible things can happen.
And I think you've put your finger on another issue, and that is this defensive, cover your own back. You know, people are, particularly I can see how senior church leaders have been so scarred by the witch hunts that have gone on over safeguarding issues in the past. And they're terrified that they're going to be the next person who is a sort of public enemy number one because, you know, they fail to recognise the safeguarding issue in their midst. I think this defensive culture means that, well, you know, let's play safe. It seemed pretty trivial, but, you know, it might be a, you know, let's call it a safeguarding issue. So this cover your own back defensiveness, I'm afraid, is, again, a very significant part of it.
It is, and it's resonant for me in particular because I did a big investigation a few years ago into a scandal in the church where effectively that, where one church figure kind of gave an exit interview where they passed on a load of rumour and innuendo and some just outright lies about vicars in this part of the Church of England. And, you know, where in a previous era that might have been kind of filtered and people said, you know, not a very reliable source. Some of this is just patently untrue. This was an organisation that was so bruised by its past failures, it was kind of terrified of dropping the ball again. So everything was automatically, without question, passed on to safeguarding. And what do safeguarding people do? Well, their job is to investigate safeguarding. So if it was on their desk, it must be safeguarding. And there was never any kind of critical lens applied. And it had tragic consequences. One of the vicars on the basis of an unverified scrap of kind of Chinese whispers rumours, was investigated on what turned out to be completely unfounded and false claims that he had been having sex with underage boys. And this dragged on for so long, over several years, and was so poorly communicated to him, he didn't know what was going on. He ended up killing himself over what was revealed to be complete nonsense. So, like, actually, this is not just about, you know, institutional efficiency. There's a real lives at stake if we can't get the right balance between HR, good HR, and robust safeguarding, and making sure things go in the right place. Identifying, is this an HR, is this safeguarding, and sending it to the right team.
Yeah. So there's a kind of very clear take-home message here, isn't there? That church leaders and people in Christian organizations need to have a robust understanding of the difference between what's an HR issue and which can be resolved locally with open discussion, compared with what's a genuine safeguarding issue. And I think that's such an important message, because for whatever reason, that message is not being clearly communicated at the moment. And I'm aware, you know, of situations in local churches where this kind of blurring and safeguarding has led to terrible damage.
And I think one other strand of it is that sometimes people who feel that they are a victim of some kind of HR failing, you know, in a workplace or in their Christian context, that their colleagues or superiors haven't treated them well, but they're aware that the HR that exists, if any, is so of such poor quality or so under-resourced or so kind of in hoc to the leader that they feel the only way to get themselves heard is to find a way to package it as a safeguarding concern. Mm-hmm. Because if they feel like if you package it as that, then it will actually get run up the chain and taken seriously. If you go, because so many Christian charities and organizations just don't do, say, HR well at all, if at all. Most of them, thank the Lord, have got some kind of safeguarding policies in place, but a lot of them have nothing in place for HR. And so some people feel like, well, I have no choice but to kind of slightly misleadingly find a way to characterize as a safeguarding, because if I ring the HR bell, no one's coming to the rescue.
Yeah, and this leads on to something I'd really like to talk about, just drawing back a bit and discuss something that I've noticed over the years. So over the years, I've been employed by a whole number of secular organisations, particularly either hospital trusts or universities. And I've also been closely involved with a number of churches, and I've been a trustee of a whole number of Christian organisations and charities. And what I've noticed is that for some strange reason, it seems that the HR problems in the churches and in the Christian organisations seems to be routinely much worse and more problematic and more damaging than in the secular organisations in which I've worked. And this has often puzzled me. Why is it that HR problems are so ubiquitous in Christian organisations? And in particular, what seems to happen is that very often there's people have some deeply traumatic encounters within this Christian organisations that they're employed with, which eventually lead to them leaving the organisation, resigning under a cloud, deeply painful, often, you know, apparently traumatised emotionally. And yet there's no kind of transparency. There's no, people just sort of smooth over it and move on. And this just seems to be a recurring theme. And so I'd be really interested to discuss, you know, why is this? I've got my own theories as to why Christian organisations are worse. But just to point out, it's strange, isn't it? You would think, if we're supposed to be the people who really understand about, you know, have this mind be in you, which is in Christ Jesus, you know.
See how much they love each other.
Exactly. You know. So,
but I think that idea is actually the heart of it, is that there is a complacency within the church world, within Christians, that, well, we're all on the same page. We are all brothers and sisters. We're all, why do we need this stuff that's copied over from the kind of secular business world? why do we need, we're not going to need, we're not going to have grievances, we're not going to fall out because we all love each other, we're all working towards this one goal. And I think there is a kind of credulousness or a naivety that why would a church need to have a dispute resolution policy or whatever? There aren't going to be disputes here.
Yeah, I definitely think that that is part of it. And it is interesting that, you know, every secular organisation knows absolutely that there's going to be problems and absolutely there are going to be disputes. And therefore, we really need to have a robust mechanism for dealing with it. And we need to have contracts and we need to have an HR department and we need to have an occupational health department and we need to have procedures and grievances and we need to have appraisal. And, you know, this is all part of how a modern secular organisation works. But that I think you're right. There is a level of naivety that says because we're all Christian brothers and sisters, you know, we don't need all these rules. We can work together as a happy team. And sadly, it very much seems that that's often not the case.
Yeah. I guess it's a failure to kind of wrestle with a truly kind of rounded Christian anthropology, which says that, yes, we're all brothers and sisters and we all love the Lord, but we're all still marred and fallen and broken by sin. And if you don't believe me, go and read the book of Acts and see how often the early church, some of the literal apostles called by Jesus himself, were constantly falling out with the best will in the world. You know, even wherever two or three Christians get together to do something, in time they will have disputes, there will be conflicts. And pretending that because we're all filled with the Holy Spirit, it will all be fine is not just naive, but it's actually profoundly unchristian. It's not reckoning with what the Bible actually teaches us about human nature.
Absolutely. And to be honest, I'm profoundly grateful that all of that does appear in the book of Acts and elsewhere in the epistles, you know, because the temptation to airbrush it out, you know, can you imagine Luke writing the book of Acts? You know, and it's all about how the Holy Spirit has come and the gospel is spreading. And, you know, and then lo and behold, Paul and Barnabas, who are two of the key players, they have this amazing bust up and they refuse to work with each other and they storm off. And you would think, do I really need to put that in? You know, couldn't I
let bygones be bygones? Yeah, this is the son of encouragement after all, Barnabas, right?
I could just airbrush that bit out. I don't really need to tell everybody. But, you know, he doesn't because of the commitment to the truth. You know, we're going to be... So I think that's right. But as I've reflected on this, I've come to the conclusion that one of the key problems is what is sometimes called a dual relationship. You know, when I was working at a secular hospital and university, I had very close work colleagues. We worked together very closely. We had all kinds of, you know, and we enjoyed one another's company. And sometimes we had big arguments and all the rest. But in the end, they were work colleagues. You know, we were doing a job, and yes, occasionally we had HR problems, and we got them sorted out. But it never had the kind of intensity that you get in a Christian organisation. But in a Christian organisation, it's not just that we're work colleagues, but actually together we are, you know, brothers and sisters embarked on a mission of eternal consequence. You know, this is something that, you know, this is the gospel, that we are God's agents. We pray together, we weep together, we long for revival and so on. And so this dual relationship, this person who is also my line manager and who is has got various targets for me and who is cracking the whip because I'm, you know, I was late to work yet again. How can that same person also be my Christian brother and sister with who we've shared at this deep level?
Mm. Yeah, and that is objectively a challenging thing to try and wrestle with. You know, I've worked at newspapers and I was very pleased that my bosses and line managers, you know, weren't also people I had a kind of deep spiritual bond with, because sometimes you have to have quite sharp, pokey conversation with them or vice versa. You know, they would do appraisals and they would say, why haven't you done this? Or you missed this deadline. Or I would say, why aren't you supporting me in this way? Or I need you to do this for me. And those are never easy conversations in the best world in the world. And even more challenging if I'm like, but I'll see you at the Friday morning, you know, prayer meeting in the office. And like, you know, all the stuff going on in my personal life, or if you're in a church context, we worship, you know, together or side by side in the pew on Sunday. And then I have to come in on Monday and do this kind of like awkward work thing. And it can be very challenging. I know some people, for example, who make a point of, I work for this church, but I don't worship there because it's just too messy. I'm going to go and worship in a different congregation so that I have some separation between my spiritual worshipping life and my kind of employment, which is for a different church. And I think there's wisdom in that, though it's obviously not always possible, most notably for the vicars and the ministers, pastors themselves. So I think that is a really tricky thing. And it's not obvious to know what to do about that, because I think clearly you don't want a Christian organization to become, for people to kind of put the guards up and not exercise their kind of spiritual brotherhood and sisterhood in Christ.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a new $5,000 matching grant that will double your gift today up to that amount. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as there is a final funding gap of $94,000 that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June the 30th. This show depends fully on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to please give your very best gift right now to close this gap, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
No, that's right. And I think there is a sense in which this dual relationship and all the problems and misunderstandings which can come from it, unfortunately, it seems to be almost, it comes with the territory. And what I've noticed is that the bigger the organization or the bigger the church, the bigger the staff team, the more problematic it becomes, the more likely it is that there's going to be misunderstandings, miscommunications, and so on.
And I think one other factor is, I think particularly in the church world that we come from, kind of evangelicalism, there is also a kind of, which I think goes back to a conversation we had months ago with Ellie Hansen, you know, the psychologist who had written the report into the John Smythe abuse scandal and identified some of these weaknesses or risk factors within evangelicalism that allowed a kind of a predator and an abuser like Smythe to thrive and to be able to find victims and keep going for so long. Some of that kind of deference is a problem, but I think also there's a kind of robust urgency that evangelicalism has. You know, a lot of evangelical leaders, I think, maybe if it's not out loud, would say, well, I can't be namby-pambying and kind of stroking the fragile egos of my junior employees. Like, there are souls to be won. There is a culture to turn back to Christ. There is a church to grow. Like, I've got this massive, eternally significant, epoch-making challenge. I need soldiers at my side, not kind of broken, hurting people who need to be bound up. I can go out there and fight for winning the lost, or even sometimes, you know, do excellent pastoral care for the hurting in the mission field, but my colleagues in the church, I don't have any space or time for them. I shouldn't have to worry about looking backwards, looking after them, which, yeah.
Absolutely right. And I'm afraid that kind of attitude is very common. I have observed it many times that church leaders who can be exquisitely pastorally sensitive when it comes to members of the flock, and particularly those, you know, who are particularly vulnerable or struggling. And then that same person goes back into the staff room and behaves in a deeply abrasive and insensitive and negative way. And I think that they would use exactly that justification, you know, that I need to be relying on my team, and I haven't the time to be namby-pambying around with them and treating them with kid gloves, you know, and we're in a war. But actually, that's exactly the point, because speak to any experienced army officer, and they will tell you that the single most important thing for winning the war is that I treat my team well,
yeah.
and my team have a high morale,
yeah.
and they know that they are respected, and they know that they are. I've got their interests,
yeah.
I've got their back, I'm there, and what's more, I'm going to sacrifice myself as the officer in order to ensure that my team gets the best possible. That's the way we win the war. It's not yeah. by, if I treat my team badly, you know. So this is worldly wisdom, and yet it's surely incredibly important.
Yeah, absolutely right. No, you're absolutely right. And I think the military metaphor is interesting because you're right that, you know, historians of war have discovered in many cases that, you know, armies which treat their, you know, their soldiers as cannon fodder and just feed them into the meat grinder often do poorly, even with if they have a superior numbers, compared to armies of smaller armies of highly motivated people who are prepared to fight for their fellow soldier and will take on huge risks voluntarily because they believe in what they're doing and because they believe that they are valued and respected and that their officers are looking after them.
And isn't this Russia versus Ukraine?
Absolutely,
you know,
right.
at the moment, it's absolutely common knowledge that Russia treats its soldiers incredibly badly, that morale is rock bottom, that soldiers are just tossed
treated
away.
Treated as disposable.
Yeah. Ukraine has a tiny army in comparison, and yet is actually protecting its soldiers, is using drones and autonomous yeah. vehicles in order to protect them, and that morale seems to be certainly much better than it is in Russia.
Yeah.
But, you know, I saw this in a different kind of warfare, which is in an intensive care unit.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I learned from my boss was that the way you treat the most junior members of the team, and in particular it's all about encouragement. So unfortunately the negative model, which quite often happened, is that, you know, the junior doctors have been there all night desperately struggling to just to keep the babies alive, you know, in a neonatal intensive care unit, and often, you know, being completely overwhelmed, but nonetheless, you know, somehow managed to make it to the morning. And, you know, in the morning, the consultant comes in and starts going looking around. And unfortunately, sometimes what the consultant does is say, well, for goodness sake, how did this happen? Why wasn't this blood test done? You know, and I've just noticed that nobody has been checking up on this. And of course, you know, if you have spent the whole night struggling to keep the babies alive, and then the first thing that happens when the consultant arrives is criticism and pointing out your failures, that is just like being kicked in the teeth. And what I learned from my boss was that he would always spend time saying, gosh, you've done a really good job here. I'm so impressed that, you know, it was clearly very difficult. And I noticed that you managed to do this and so on. But perhaps just this one thing, if I could just point out, you know, but in other words, he would, it's, and this is the phenomenon that he was so well aware of, which is what's called the negativity bias, this very well-known psychological phenomenon. That is that everybody is so much more sensitive to criticism than they are to encouragement. And I know it for myself, you know, that if I am given a talk and I get 9 positive comments and I get 1 negative comment, it's that 1 negative comment that I completely can't get out of my head. And so this is something that surely that church leaders ought to be much more aware of.
I know, absolutely right. And it's kind of shocking to me that it's not better understood, because, I mean, I learned that message, you know, about probably when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, about if you give someone feedback, you need to preface it with encouragement and positive feedback, and then you get to the stuff that they could do better. And ideally, you then circle around at the end and repeat some positive feedback, so that it's the negativity or the stuff to work on is kind of sandwiched by here's what you did really well. And that's just basic understanding of human psychology, and it's just the kind, loving thing to do. Like, you know, let's not be around the bush. This is the kind, loving thing to do, is to say, you did this really well. You should be really proud. I really liked what you said here. You know, I did wonder, maybe you could try this next time, or, you know, had you thought about X, Y, and Z? But overall, I thought you did a really good job and you should be happy with, you know, it's just basic how to treat people well, and also, frankly, how to get the most out of someone. If you want, actually, the next time they do that sermon, or the next time they deliver that operation, to do it better, they're going to do that if they feel like they're 90% of the way there and here's a thing they can work on, rather than if you ball them out, tear a strip off them, and effectively tell them that everything they did was wrong.
Yeah,
it's just basic stuff. Why don't more people understand that?
Well, and it's so interesting, isn't it? If you think about it, you can see Paul doing this in the epistles. You know, so often the epistles start with, I thank God for you. Every time I remember you, I pray. I'm so encouraged by what you're doing, you know. And then, you know, I wish you could do X, Y, Z. But then he ends it again often with a really positive.
It does.
And I was just thinking again, this wonderful last chapter of Romans, where he just spends his time thanking individual people, saying, you know, give my greetings to X, and she was a mother to me, and he was a faithful soldier. And there's this a real that Paul is taking the time to affirm and encourage the individuals who are often under enormous pressure. So I would certainly say I think that's one of the most important messages for all kind of HR, but particularly, so why, if this is so obvious that you and I, you know, and certainly when I was leading a team, that was something that was at the top of my head, was how could I encourage and support my team? Why is this not 101 in church culture?
That's a great question. I don't honestly have a good answer for it. I wonder if, you know, this is a bit provocative thing to say, but I wonder if part of the answer here is that I do observe that there are Christians who kind of stay within the Christian world exclusively, and they go straight out of university to working for their church in some kind of junior context, and then they sidestep to this Christian charity or ministry here, and you can get into your 30s or 40s and have literally never worked in the real world, quote unquote, for any kind of secular organization utilizing like modern standard HR practice. And I think if you have a church or a Christian organization full of those kinds of people, they genuinely don't know how the rest of the world works. And I think that sometimes you get this kind of insular bubble approach where either we don't think we have anything to learn from the outside world, or we just don't know what we don't know because everyone here has only ever worked. And it's all been kind of slightly ad hoc, thrown together on a shoestring. No one's ever done any training in any of this. No one's ever actually been told what it looks like to line manage someone well. We just assume you're a Christian, you can probably figure it out. And there's this kind of, on a wing and a prayerness of some Christian organizations, even ones that might actually have very large budgets and be doing quite big, heavy duty stuff, sometimes run by surprisingly unprofessional or underqualified, underexperienced people.
I'm afraid I think there's a huge amount of truth in that. And thinking about it, I learned so much from watching senior colleagues. You know, as a junior doctor, it was one of the things I learned most about, you know, how watching, it's a kind of apprenticeship. You watch how the seniors manage situations, how they manage this patient complaint, how they manage this difficult junior, how they navigate. And I remember thinking, yeah, well, I watched that, and that really is a very bad way of dealing with it. I definitely won't do it that way. Yeah. And then I watched somebody else, and I say, you know what? That was such a brilliant way they handled that situation. I'm really going to remember that. So it's that modelling, that observing, that watching different people navigate and manage different situations. Mm. I mean, one of the things I also learned, and that was how to manage when something very bad has happened, you know, when unintended, but some disaster has happened, and how you navigate that. And one of the things I learned the senior consultants doing well was they would, discuss quite openly how this happened, but just wanting to be honest and let's just discuss it. Let's understand, you know, how was the decision made and why did it go wrong and why wasn't that answered and so on and so on. But then in the kind of debriefing feedback, when it was appropriate, they would often then share from their own experience some other disasters. This reminds me of a case, a terrible case when I was involved with X, Y, Z, and actually, it was extremely helpful because you suddenly thought, oh yeah, well, this was pretty bad, but actually, that was much worse. But it's that kind of humility, and you know, within the safety of a team meeting, to be able to be a human being and talk about failures. Again, I'm afraid, I think church leaders are very, very loath to do that. They feel, you know, I've got to maintain appearances, I've got to maintain respect, you know, I don't want to talk about my failures. And yet again, you look at the epistles, look at Paul talking about his own failures and, you know, and his background and making himself vulnerable. So I think there's definitely something there, again, which is just is a sort of authenticity, humility, transparency.
I think key one here as well is having a sense of internal security. And I think the leaders who are able to be honest about their failings and work collaboratively to do better next time are able to do that because they are personally secure.
Yeah.
And if you are insecure about your position or your capacities and abilities, it's too threatening to kind of open Pandora's box and see and look inside and say, oh, guys, actually, I really messed that up. And I think insecurity is obviously commonplace everywhere, but I do notice there's lots of church leaders who are, despite maybe having or the appearance of exercising a lot of authority, are often quite insecure. And I think if there are some industries, I think aviation is one and others, where they've kind of developed this process of, we put blame to one side, something has gone wrong, our job is to figure out what happened and how to fix it. And at this point, we're going to just put park for a moment. We're not pointing the finger at anyone. We're just saying, and that gives space for people to be honest, that, do you know what, actually, I didn't do that. Yeah. And that's how you get, and that, you know, and that kind of constant refining and self-reflection and kind of, You can be honest and admit mistakes because you feel confident that your peers are not going to chew you out or throw you out of your job, actually leads to better outcomes for patients or fewer airplane crashes or whatever that kind of desired outcome is.
Yes. I think there's definitely a huge amount of that. I've also noticed that how much the personal security, the psychological security of the leader will affect the atmosphere of the team that they run, and that when the leader is able to is secure enough to be able to make themselves vulnerable, it's like everyone relaxes.
Yeah.
You know, because and also I think the teacher, the leader needs to be able to model that they are prepared to take criticism, you know, they're prepared to take challenge.
Yeah, they can laugh at themselves.
They can, yeah, absolutely, yeah, and the failures. And maybe again, it's the kind of seriousness or the perceived seriousness of the spiritual calling that makes it harder for Christian leaders to be able to laugh at themselves. But I think it is a it is an important thing. So if I was going to give some kind of rules for or recommendations, you know, or where I think, see that things that are constantly broken, I would say, first of all, the culture comes from the top. So that is the single most, this is the most important thing, is the most senior person has to set the culture for the organization. They have to model. There's no point telling people what they want to do unless they are modeling it themselves. And secondly, this thing about negativity bias, you know, the leaders really need to put that into practice. They need to be very, very careful about robust feedback, because it does so much damage unless it is, and this constant need for encouragement. Third, I think truth and transparency. an openness. You know, unfortunately, so often when there are difficulties, it seems that Christian organizations are not able to be transparent, either in public or in private. Even in the team meeting, I've heard people say, I still have no idea what's going on. I still have no idea why that person left.
Yeah.
You know, I have no idea what that terrible bust-up was about.
Very cool.
The whole thing is just being, you know, closed down.
And this strikes at, I think, what is one of the core lessons the church has been trying to learn from its abuse safeguarding issues, to circle back where we started. So many of these abuse scandals not took place in the first place, but were covered up or not properly dealt with, is because people were terrified that it would harm the ministry and the mission of the church. You know, if this got out, it would do such damage to God's kingdom and to God's work. And so the Christian, the responsible thing to do is to try and deal with it completely secretly, behind closed doors, internally. And that is so, is one, not true. God's kingdom is strong enough to withstand the revelation that he is, that in his church are people of with feet of clay. But it's also so destructive to the victims. And also when it does eventually come out, it actually ruins the church reputation even further. And I see this in a smaller scale with kind of HR issues. I can think of Christian organizations where some of the junior people were very aware that how they were being treated by their superiors was poor, that the HR was not being done well, that their rights were not being respected, they were not being treated with honor and integrity, but they were terrified or felt unable to raise the flag or to go out in a blaze of glory because they were desperate to protect the work because they believed in the mission. And so they just quietly resign and they just brush under the carpet and they kind of collude in their employers. And I don't want to be victim blaming here, but to an extent they kind of collude in their employers or their seniors' mishandling of the situation because they're so desperate to not show the scars, to not reveal to the kind of skeptical watching world that actually another Christian charity is riddled with poor practice. And again, that is an understandable impulse, but I think it must be resisted, that we must say that actually transparency and truth-telling is a Christian virtue, even when it is truth-telling uncomfortable truths about God's people and God's church.
And that's something that we've absolutely learned from the abuse scandals, because, you know, in my lifetime, I can remember, you know, back in the 1980s, when I was a very junior member of a board of some organisations, it was just assumed that, yes, if something really bad had happened, that was bad. But the single most important thing is preserving the reputation of the work, because this is God's work and it's his reputation is at stake. And therefore, we have to preserve the reputation of this organisation, the public reputation. Whereas now, knowing well, now not we know, you know, I know that that's wrong. I know that it's more important to be honest and truthful than it is to preserve the reputation of any human organization. So I think that's a really important thing. I think that one of the interesting ideas is that leaders have both hard power and soft power. They have hard power in the sense that they can actually sort of employ and fire people and set their work conditions, but they also have soft power in this sense that we've talked about modeling culture and influence and persuasion and because of their status as a church leader or as an organizational leader. So the question is, it's the godly use of power. Am I using power in a godly way? Yes, there is power. I do have power. But the challenge is to use it in a godly way, as opposed to an abusive, manipulative, destructive way.
Yeah, and we shouldn't shy away from the fact. I think sometimes, and we talked in previous episodes about culture has an interesting take on power and authority at the moment, and is kind of allergic to it in some senses, and sees power and balances everywhere, and sees them as intrinsically abusive. And I think we should be cautious about that. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with hierarchy. There's nothing In fact, many Christian organizations wouldn't operate well if there wasn't some people with more power than others. But the critical thing, as you say, is all of this HR stuff comes down to how is that power and authority being exercised. And what is so encouraging, right, is that we have a model. You go to the Gospels and you see Jesus Christ, who held all power and authority had been given to him by the Father. Let's go and attend and read and learn at his feet. How did he exercise that power? And that's, you know, not always easy and obvious to apply that to a work context, but we have this model of servant leadership, of power, of absolute extreme eternal power being held with such sensitivity and grace.
Absolutely. And it's a reminder for all of us, isn't it? Because Jesus redefines what power is.
Yes.
I mean, you know, he washes feet. He sacrifices himself. He is handed over. But in so doing, he triumphs. So it's a complete redefinition of power. And I think effective leaders learn from that and model it. And of course, it's a very high calling, and we fail constantly, which again is why humility, recognition of failure, and authenticity and transparency are so important. I mean, there's one other thing that I personally feel very strongly about, and that is that so many organisations, and here it's secular organisations as well as church organisations, have a very bad email culture. And I have seen time and time again really horrific things happening because of emails. I mean, for instance, in my university, I saw people who had to resign, who sent an email in error, you know, and copied all what was a really quite painful and difficult email, and it caused such horrendous damage that they had to resign. It was the end of their career, almost, you know, from sending one email. So in other words, before you press send, always think about, you know, the implications of sending this email. But I personally feel that email is very good for things that are completely neutral, like, you know, let's meet at 9:30, you know, or, you know, can we change the address, please, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Something that is entirely emotionally neutral. All that things have clearly positive connotations. You know, I've just heard the news. Wonderful news. Well done. Congratulations. That's fantastic. Isn't that good? Et cetera, et cetera. But any message that has potentially negative connotations, that is going to be seen as something critical, negative, damaging, and all the rest, I think shouldn't be sent by email. The best way of conveying negative and difficult news is always face-to-face. And even though that's a pain to have to say, you know, I'm really sorry, but could we arrange, we really need to talk face-to-face. Is there any possibility you could do it, you know, later today or as soon as possible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you can't do it face-to-face, then the second best is to do it on the phone, on a live phone call. Because it's so important to be able to monitor and get the feedback and respond to the way that, when you're giving bad information, critical information, feedback is so important.
And you need the context that you get in human voices. And when people read negative things in emails, they read into the worst possible way this sentence could be delivered.
And also, you've no idea where that email is going to land. You know, so for instance, they've just had terrible news from something else in the family. They sit down at their computer, they click on that email, and bang. But the other thing is that they can copy and paste. You know, do you just see what my boss has said to me? You know, I'll just send this round to my mates, and you know, the whole thing escalates. So I think just basic education about a healthy email culture, the way we use emails, also when we send them. Do you send a really, you know, important email at 10 o'clock at night? You know?
Or 4:45 p.m. on a Friday evening, you know, Friday afternoon.
Exactly.
No, I think there's a lot of wisdom there. And I think, you know, a lot of this is not rocket science. It's stuff that, as you say, the secular world has tumbled into a while ago, while not being perfect at it. And I just think it's one of those areas where the church needs to kind of have the humility to say, do you know what, there might be some things that we could learn from these millions of outside organisations that also wrestle with, we have the same flawed, broken, sinful human beings working together at some shared enterprise and falling out, and we want to love and treat people well. How do we do that? you know, yes, there's loads of wisdom in scripture, and we should absolutely go and reread some of those epistles that you talked about, the Pauline epistles, and see how Paul tries to navigate conflict, or in Acts. But also, like, you know, it wouldn't kill you to go and get some training or read up on, like, what is best practice for email etiquette or line management or annual appraisals. You know, we take it, you know, we don't have to be too proud to believe there's nothing we can learn from the secular world.
It's absolutely right. And what's more, the secular organizations that I've been on had mandatory staff training. You know, you had to go off and learn about how to manage a team and how to manage conflicts, and as well as the fire arrangements and so on. You know, there are some things that are just mandatory. And so wouldn't it be good if even small churches had mandatory staff training, which the rectors had to go to as well?
Yeah. And in the Church of England context, that's certainly the case on safeguarding. As anyone who's involved in any Anglican church will know, you basically can't do anything. You know, you can't be a welcomer on the door without off on the mandatory C of E safeguarding training. And if we're serious about trying to keep safeguarding be safeguarding and HR be HR, then we probably need some HR training. You know, we shouldn't assume that this is obvious, easy stuff that everyone can do instinctively. People need to learn. And I think that, yeah, that can only be helpful, though I'm sure it's not something anyone would welcome. Here's your email invitation to the 2027 HR training module CR225B.
You heard it here. You know, we deal with the really good stuff.
Yeah, start the campaign. More HR training in churches. When do we want it? Now. Right, shall we draw to a close? Bit of a different episode today, but as you can tell, something we feel relatively strongly about for unusual reasons. We'd love to know your own thoughts, your own experiences, if you had good or bad HR in a church context, or in your work context. What are the other things that you think the church could be learning, stuff that we missed, stuff that we've got wrong? We'd love to hear your thoughts, so please do email us, molad@premier.org.uk. And as ever, there's lots to read on Dad's website, other resources from the kind of stuff that you'll be used to from the podcast, and all other things beside. That's John Wyatt, W-Y-A-T-T, johnwyatt.com. And you can find some of my journalism, including my in-depth coverage of the Church of England and much more besides, on my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, I'd encourage you to sign up for my free weekly Substack newsletter called The Critical Friend, which you can do through tswyatt.com. That's it. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
When maintaining your daily wellness rituals is important to you, the change in routine during the summer can feel daunting. Kachava's new travel packs help you stick to your daily ritual, even when you're on the go. Just one packet of Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake provides complete nutrition with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and much more. So you'll be fueled and ready for wherever life or your summer adventures take you. No fillers, no nonsense, just the good stuff your body craves. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. But you can try it for yourself because the Variety Pack includes all 6 delicious fan favorites: chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry. So instead of worrying about sticking to your daily ritual, simplify it with Kachava. Go to kachava.com and use code FITNESS for 15% off. That's KACHAVA.com, code FITNESS.